Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, I'm Steph.
And I'm Simon.
And welcome to The Food Fight, where we offer a different perspective on food culture issues around Australia and the world.
We'll talk with chefs, producers, business owners and experts to hear their stories and find out what makes them tick.
This episode, we're speaking with Dr. Blair Williams and Dr. Kim Hewan from the ANU about multiculturalism and its representation in popular food media. All right, let's go. Welcome to another episode of the Food Fight Podcast. My name is Steph Postuma with my co-host, as always, Simon Evans.
Morning.
And we find ourselves here at the ANU in Canberra with Dr. Blair Williams and Dr. Kim Hewan. Welcome, guys.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much for joining us. Guys, we start our podcast with an acknowledgement of country. So today, and it is NAIDOC week this week, we must mention as well, today we'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people who are the traditional custodians of the land where we are gathering here today and pay respect to elders past, present and emerging. All right, guys, let's kick off the podcast. This is an interesting one for us, and it's great to be able to talk to a couple of academics like yourselves, particularly about this issue, because I think that beyond, you know, some of the work that you've done and the writing that you've done, there's a lot to talk about when it comes to multiculturalism and food in Australia. You know, it's such a deep and broad subject that we can talk about for probably ever. But I think to kick off, it's probably important we get a background of what you guys do, what you guys sort of work on in your sort of academic sphere. So Blair, we'll start with you.
I'm a gender politics scholar. So I mostly focus on media coverage of women politicians, prime ministers, that kind of stuff. But I'm more, I'm generally quite focused and interested on the media in general. You know, how the media portrays things, covers things, whether it's women or, you know, racism, sexism, homophobia, that kind of stuff. And I also teach a lot of different courses like race and representation in politics, as well as refugee politics with my colleague, Kim. So yeah, I'm generally quite interested in those kinds of areas.
Okay. Kim?
I'm a part-time scholar, so I teach refugee politics with Blair, teach political philosophy, food-related sort of. I host a ABC Radio Canberra program called Sunday Brunch. We talk a bit about food amongst many other things. And I grew up working in a Vietnamese bakery in Canberra.
Love it. Awesome. Okay, well, to get started, we sort of became aware of you guys based on an article in The Conversation that you wrote. Was it last year or this year?
No, it was this year.
September.
Not long ago. Yeah, September. Okay, sorry.
It was like 5 years ago.
I read a lot of Conversation articles. and the article's titled, Channel 7's Plate of Origin Shows How Australian Multiculturalism is Defined by White People. So, Blair, why don't you just get us started? For people, obviously, not everyone who's listening to this podcast has read this article, but I urge them to do so. Do you want to tell us a bit about, you know, maybe we start off by giving people the premise of Plate of Origin, what the show is, and then get into what your article discusses?
Yeah, sure. I mean, as a white person, just acknowledge that one, because your viewers can't see me. Sorry, listeners can't see me. I think it's, you know, something that's important to critique, you know, in general, these kinds of shows. And Plate of Origin is a cooking show, as we know, that was essentially a competition between teams of two people that were framed as, say, Team China or Team Australia, Team how many teams are there? Team Vietnam, Team India, yeah, all those, you know,
10.
Yeah.
10 teams.
And it was framing this as a competition of, you know, which which cuisine is better, essentially. So they had to compete with each other in a series of different tests, essentially, to see supposedly who was the best cook. And who decided this was a panel of white judges, essentially. And it was just quite interesting in how that was portrayed. Not only competing these different so-called countries' cuisines, but also having a Team Australia full of two white men and being judged by a panel of fellow white men.
Mm-hmm. And this, I should say, this was Blair's idea. And I'm just the token brown and yellow guy. And even then, it's compromised because it'd be a banana for many people.
Oh my God.
So that's the great hypocrisy of our article, that the power dynamics that we were critiquing in the show were actually reflected in the writing of the article. I was just doing the legwork and the editing, and she was like pushing me around and then used me for the representation sort of value. We've got several critiques of the show that we lay out in the article, but... And the acronym we do know, the editors kicked it out, is POO, Plate of Origin, right? But we poo-poo on the show, but in part it's because it does a disservice to Australian food, Australian society, Australian culture, which is much richer and more dynamic than that.
Yep.
You know what I mean? It's not that we poo-poo on the idea of multicultural food or the idea of celebrating it, but that show did a great disservice, I think, in many ways to... The wondrous reality of Australian multicultural life.
It was quite a confusing show in general. They never really laid out like it was the whole time I was watching. It was like, what's the point here? Like, what are they trying to achieve? What are they trying to prove? Are they trying to like, are these people the best chefs they could find who fit into their Team China, Team Colombia? How do they find these people? Whoever wins, what does that say about something? Like, why are they? Why is there a $100,000 prize for this? Like, it was all just quite confusing the whole way through, I found.
Yeah, so, I mean, sort of delving into this sort of disservice to multiculturalism, can we talk a bit about how these different cultures were represented on the show? I mean, obviously the production of the show sort of had, you know, you've got the villainous... French, the sassy Venezuelans, mm-hmm. are these sort of stereotypes that we should be worrying about, the way that these people were produced in such ways?
I don't know. What do you think?
Oh, I think, I mean, in some senses, that term essentialize is important. I don't mind that there is a sassy South American and they're red-blooded and all that, and I think... If you look at the particular teams, it's more that they're expected to fulfill those roles. They were on show to fulfill certain roles, and they didn't have a huge amount of room to push those boundaries. And when they did, actually, it became quite quite irksome and difficult in the sense for particularly some if you judge on dessert and your cuisine doesn't fit into the three. Anglo Francophile judges' ideas of dessert, then you're going to be in a bit of woe, right? They didn't have the capacity to deal with that.
Yeah,
it was very Eurocentric in how they saw food and main courses and entrees and desserts and those sorts of things. And just desserts in general, I think, is a problem with MasterChef and other shows. Every time you have a so-called like Asian team or Asian person, and they cook traditionally Asian desserts, a lot of the times the judges very much judge that and, ask them to essentially Eurocentrize it.
Like a word.
Europeanize it, maybe.
And in a sense, there's a hierarchy there because a show like so these sort of shows can work, but you should in turn reflect upon what is standard food, what is white food, what is European food. Mm. Like, for instance, there is a distinctive discrimination of sweet and sour. I'm not an expert at this in the fact that there is a dessert and there's a savory main and entree, right?
Yeah.
But for Southeast Asians, I have to go to any restaurant. Sweet and sour is mixed up everywhere and salty. You have watermelon with chili and salt. You know what I mean? And I don't mind those comparisons and those differences, but one should. But the show set a hierarchy in which this is sort of distinction of taste is how all these other cultures will be judged.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that was the first episode. And the Chinese team did a dessert, and it was, and all the other contestants judging it said the same thing: was it's not sweet enough. But that, I mean, it comes down to the cultural or history of their cuisine. That's the way desserts are. And desserts don't have to be. There's no rule. Desserts have to be sweet. Like, it's the final course. Like,
my Chinese mate has a great line: I don't do sweets. But it's a particular type of Chinese too, isn't it? Because he's from an area where they don't really do the sweets. Yeah. So it's complex.
Develop different palates from the food they eat. So what can be sweet? And, you know, everyone has a different palate and where they perceive taste. So what is sweet to someone else, can be like just a little bit of sugar, can be completely, you know, savory to another person. So it very much is dictated by the way your palate's developed and the history of your cuisine and what you've grown up eating and all these different things.
But if we're looking at the teams too, there's an issue with the Australian team, Stu and I think it was Evan, I can't remember, but that they, like, once again, I'm not, if you did this a bit tongue-in-cheek, I'd sort of laugh a bit, but it wasn't. It was earnestly, the Australian team is the norm, it's two white blokes.
Yeah.
You know, and where was the Indigenous team? So many people were saying Indigenous Australian team. Well, why would they made choices. This is the producers of this show. They make choices. They can make choices about being exciting, about being diverse, about being dynamic, or they can choose to reinforce existing stereotypes. That's fine. That's your choice. But what was mostly uplifting about the show, and I didn't get any pleasure out of this, but that it bombed. It bombed and it showed this is not what Australians... It bombed in... Like, still hundreds of thousands of people watching it, but far less so than the other show.
They played the last three episodes on the same night to get it over with.
The pleasure I got was that the Australian team lost in a meat pie challenge.
Blair, we can talk about this choice a little bit more. So, I mean, these shows historically now, especially things like MasterChef and My Kitchen Rules and those sorts of things, have been the highest rating shows in Australia, essentially. Like, really, really popular. And really influential on, you know, how food culture runs, the demands of the public, what people consume and what people buy. Like, they set trends. They put professional chefs as judges giving them a huge platform and a huge profile, because they are the people that they sort of sit in between popular culture and the hospitality industry and can sort of drive decision making in those things. They're hugely influential. How do you see these choices being made, where people are sitting in a room like we are now, this conference room at the ANU, and are making decisions about what this show is going to be and how we're going to try to sell it? Because, like, at the end of the day, they just want to get as much viewers as they can. That's their ultimate goal. Yeah. And they made the choice to represent Australia as two white men who are just your Aussie larrikins that love meat and three veg, which they cooked in one of the episodes as like a fine dining sort of style dish.
As their example of what Australian cuisine is.
Is this sort of, I mean, how does this reflect our media landscape? Like, is this just more of the same sort of thing and people aren't starting to realise, you know, the opportunity that we sort of talked about before?
I think the interesting thing, and I guess why this show perhaps was quite shocking in a way, was that it came out, I think, a few weeks after the media report that showed how little diversity there is in mainstream media in Australia. You know, looking at Channel 7 or ABC or Channel 10, all the different mainstream channels, and showing, you know, it showed essentially that there are hardly any faces of colour on our TV screens, that is predominantly white. And then you have, you know, the show come out and it shows a promise of multiculturalism, of diversity, but the way it does it is to exoticise them, to portray them as different, and it's not, you know, not quite Australian. So to make those decisions, I mean, I guess it's reflective of the media industry being so damned white. But also, I mean, I was sitting there watching the show going, why even have a Team Australia? If you're having a competition of different cuisines, why not just have all the other cuisines? Why not have a Team UK if you want to have, you know, like that kind of Anglo white people food? Or why not have an Indigenous team? I mean, it's fantastic Indigenous chefs. You know, we've seen Indigenous ingredients and foods in recent years and say, like, MasterChef. Or SBS. I mean, why not do those things? So as Kim was saying, these are conscious choices that are being made, and they're made to, I guess, reinforce the status quo in our country.
Do you seen? Have you sort of kept in touch with what was happening on the last season of MasterChef?
I love MasterChef.
Yeah,
it's okay. A guilty pleasure.
Yeah. So,
but it was a contrast from MasterChef to Plate of Origin.
Yeah.
From the new judges. You know, with Melissa Leong. Who is fantastic on MasterChef. I think she's a cult following on MasterChef. To Plate of Origin with like three white dudes.
Mm. And I think in the last season, I haven't been watching MasterChef, but in the last season, sort of, you know, it just so happened that something like six out of the last eight contestants were Asian, and you've got an Asian judge as well, and they really chose to focus in on the fact that this happened, creating sort of shows and producing pieces with people bringing in, you know, family recipes, family photos and things, and celebrating their Asian heritage. Like, do you see sort of MasterChef perhaps getting it right and sort of being on a path to something that's a bit more representative and, you know, a bit more 2020 when it comes to food media.
I have critiques of MasterChef as well. I mean, you say that, I can't remember the numbers, but you said six out of eight.
I can't remember, something like that.
I mean, I remember there were a lot of Asian contestants and it was fantastic, and I was on Twitter watching, you know, reading a lot of the comments from renowned Asian Australian chefs here. But then you get to the grand final and it's between two white women. So I find that interesting how they like kind of whittle it down through what I see as kind of like Eurocentric food challenges. You know, whether it's a challenge that tries to, what was it, fine dine different cuisines around the world. That was a quite notorious episode that got a bit of flack. Or other challenges that were based on, you know, a lot of, I guess, European ingredients and styles of cooking. And so I think, I don't know, to me, I see MasterChef as a potential of something that can go well, but currently there's still, you know, a lot of things to critique in that sense. They still have a lot of improving to do, I think, to be truly representative.
Yeah, you outline in your article sort of a quote from Jock Zonfrillo, as a part of MasterChef, where he talks about Asian ingredients not automatically lending themselves to fine dining. And a really, really great response from Adam Lior on Twitter, where he says, Asian cuisines are full of fine dining. Kaiseki, Confucian cuisine, Thai and Vietnamese court cuisine, almost any regional cuisine in China, Peranakan food. It's just that Eurocentric conceptualization of Michelin, World's Best 50, etc., constantly ignores it. Hashtag MasterChef AU. Yeah, like I guess it's just another indication that you know.
I mean, that's quite a trope. That, same as that, like, you know, Asian cuisine can't do desserts. It's just like it's a thing that just kind of is in people's heads. They just think it's a fact, when it's you know, demonstrably not. But there seems like there's plenty of those things in that kind of area. And when it's just quite obvious. I mean, Michelin are in Asia quite heavily now, and do rate lots of restaurants there. So it's such a strange that's kind of still permeated in people's psyche. And even someone who's on telly and is about to, I'm going to say this, thinking like he's confident enough that was like a true fact that everyone will agree with, and that will just, you know, just fly with the contestants he's sailing to.
And on that episode, they got a white man in to gentrify and, you know, the food. I can't remember the chef's name, but, you know, he's known for traveling the world and then taking those recipes from different cultures and fine dining them, in quote marks, which is just, you know, quite ridiculous. So I guess, yeah, Jock felt it was okay to say those things because of the whole premise of the show, of the episode, which is, I don't know, what do you think, Kim?
Maybe I'll go back and I'll make a couple of points about choices. I thought the key choice in making the show Plate of Origin was around the judges, that they had
100% agree.
Three blokes that were hanging around who had big histories and they thought they could make money off those three blokes, right? So it's a rather conservative decision. I'm not saying And I'm judging it in some ways, but mostly because out of interest, I wonder if it relates to... And remember, they're coming off shows that have had rocky histories with their previous associates. Colin Barr is through his restaurants and not paying people. And Steve Evans too, and Pete. Some of his
Pete Evans.
My apologies, yeah. And some of his arguably wacky ideas. So it coincides.
Should we say arguably?
So the choice of so at the same time, and there's no. I just wonder about whether that's a statement, those choices about the judge. It's a conservative statement, I think one can say that. But if it does run in parallel with a certain white old bloke backlash, and this is Trump's been elected out, it seems now, but this all goes around at the same time of this vibe in the world that there's a very strong backlash of white blokes who feel like times are changing and this is their last stand. And that sort of ran along that decision, I think, to choose these old blokes. Their mates had been discredited for their craziness, for their ripping other people off. But we have to reassert their position in society as great judges, as the figureheads of taste, of nutrition, of all those other things that food represents, of culture. So that's I think that was one of the key choices of the show, and that how it relates to a time, a certain vibe in politics, and an anxiety around older blokes. Mm. And the other interesting, and the more, and because I'm a wanker and I'm do politics and philosophy, I am interested more in the broader choice that we make about watching reality TV and food shows in particular. Throughout the 1990s, I thought reality and the noughties, I thought reality TV was gone with Big Brother. You know, yep. Big Brother was huge. Yeah. I was like, nah, that's looking crap now. There's no way it's gone down the gurgler. But reality TV's gone to strength. But why it's related to, and I can hear people switching off now, why it's related to a bigger vibe about politics is there's a certain theory that particularly domestic and homely shows give people comfort at a time of great change. And the key term for us in politics people is globalization, right? Mm. There's all these sorts of different new people coming on. Your economy's changing. You know, all this money's coming from China and all over the place. It's destabilizing your job. You never know if you're going to get a, you know, and this is the food industry is symptomatic of this. You never know if you're going to get a permanent job. Starting in the 80s, 90s, and in the noughties.
I'd say neoliberalism then, more than globalization.
Yeah. And so what's the offset for that? Well, you go home and you watch your home shows and you turn inwards more and you start having a resort-style living at home and stuff like that. And the TV, you watch Border Security, which is bigger than State of Origin during the noughties too, you know. We start watching those sort of shows that turn us inwards because we're afraid of a changing world, logically speaking. But that's why food shows interest me somewhat, particularly MasterChef, because it shows a sign of us not needing those comforts a bit more. So if the desire for food that is dynamic, that challenges us a bit, that makes us look about our own eating habits, you know, that suggests a certain desire to not be inward looking anymore. I could be wrong, but that's why I'm interested in culture. I'm interested in what culture says about politics, about the way we live, about the way we relate to one another. So food shows are very, very interesting in that regard.
I think it's, MasterChef's an interesting one because they do, I mean, Simon and I being involved in the food and hospitality industries and sort of having our fingers on the pulse of food trends and what's happening in food media, a lot of the time come across the guests to MasterChef a long time before they appear on MasterChef. So people like Jox on Frillo, who has or had Arana Restaurant in Adelaide and was championing Indigenous produce and working with the Arana Foundation to establish an Indigenous food and native food database, and, you know, has probably been the most influential person in, you know, food media and the most influential popular chef on promoting Indigenous food. You know, he came to MasterChef and has imparted his background on that. And that's another thing that sort of feeds into that challenge that you're talking about, Kim. And the same when it comes to other chefs that they have, like they've had Josh Nyland on the program, who is all about seafood sustainability and shows us that fish can be something that you use 90% of the weight of each fish in your cooking rather than what has traditionally been 50%, because, you know, guts and bones and gills and all those sorts of things traditionally would always get thrown away. So it is interesting to see MasterChef on the other side of the coin in terms of, you know, bringing these sorts of ideas to a new popular audience, to people who are interested in food and might have been, you know, fans of you know, just your more sort of sensational and fluffy cooking shows in the past, but being challenged with, you know, their ideas about what food is.
So I think that food media and cooking shows that can have a massive influence on the way we think, because everyone cooks or everyone eats a minimum.
Mm.
So everyone has, and I find this owning restaurants, everyone has a fucking opinion about food because everyone can do it. It's very accessible. You can, you know, it's not unachievable. It's, you know, it's kind of difference of why, you know, scientists at CERN aren't celebrities, because you most people can't understand what they're doing and can't recreate it, replicate it. Chefs are relatable.
Mm.
Like, everyone cooks, they cook food, they do it, they might do it slightly better, might do it more fancy, but it seems achievable. So people really buy into that. And like, seeing how people want to be at home and turn inwards and see something that's comforting. I think you can watch a chef and be like, I could do that. Well, that doesn't look that hard. Like, oh, I can tell. And you can.
Well, they kind of create that equalization with the contestants, right?
Yeah.
Because you've got a chef on there showing this amazing expertise, butchering a kingfish into 100 mm-hmm. different parts,
mm.
and the contestants going, wow, and then they participate in a challenge.
They play the chef against the contestant.
Well, there you go.
And I mean, so that just shows that, like, they're like, oh, we're not that far from a chef. And it's like very different things, like being a chef as a job and cooking a single dish on a show or cooking a dish at home.
Yeah, have the stamina for like, what, 15 hours?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I mean, it's a kind of false equivalency in that way, that they're comparing two different things. But yeah, they cooking shows definitely, with their viewership and because people buy into it, can really dictate what people see as right. So like I said, having something like a Team Australia when they're just cooking Anglo-French Celtic dishes the whole time just seems completely pointless. And I think
mostly British dishes.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the French techniques,
which is British.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I think why Australia is desperate to find some culture in a young country and to be like, this is Australian food, and it really isn't. Mm. Isn't Australian food is Aboriginal culture and Indigenous ingredients. So that's just what it is. There's no white Australian.
I mean, to me, just
food cuisine.
Comes back to the culture. Question of like, what is Australia? What is Australian food? What is Australian culture? And you know, I think the show kind of maybe tries. I don't know if they try to tackle that question, but the question arises, and I think they fail to answer it. Really, you know, the show kind of insinuates that Australian culture and Australian food is white male culture and white male food, which is British based.
At two times, at one point they were trying to, by the whole show was trying to say that Australia is this amazing mingling of dishes and cuisines, and then they said, right, you guys cook just Chinese food, you guys cook just Venezuelan food, and Australia, you cook the stuff that your ancestors cooked. So saying that Australia is multicultural and having the Australian team cook European dishes, it just kind of negated the whole point of the show with that one team.
Mm-hmm.
Which is quite ironic.
It's been a great. I've been rapt by to be able to think about this. It shows the importance of food to understanding culture in many ways. And Blair was saying, I've been thinking for ages about, as a refugee too, what does it mean to be Australian? Because the refugees often have to remake their sense of identity, right? So I think that's why this show is still very important to me. It does show what's right and wrong about multiculturalism, but it helps us think about what's Australian, what's Venezuelan, what's Vietnamese. Mm. Ultimately, for me, once again, the footnote about being a philosophical wanker, these cultural and food boundaries are imagined. They're imagined boundaries, right? But that's not to say that they fake or they don't exist, at least for me. But it's to emphasise that the imagining is an ongoing act and process that we all take part in. So and then for me, it helps me think about, well, what does it mean? How permeable are those boundaries? How should we move in with between them? It doesn't mean that I can never cook Venezuelan food, all right? Surely it means rather that what we should aim for is that all of those boundaries are permeable, but we cross them with respect and with a certain amount of respect and excitement and open-heartedness and open-mindedness and humility, and then we can, you know what I mean? And whereas there I think is the problem with some aspects of multiculturalism in Australia and which Pooh Plate of Origin highlights is that they're not crossing those boundaries are put up. What we mean by centralized, those boundaries are put up as if that they're natural and there forever. and that they can't be cross and stagnant, and B, that there is a hierarchy within those different pockets of foods and cultures. Right? So I think thinking about it, I'm so glad to think about it more, because you sort of write things and you sort of don't even, you know, but it's only through talking about it like this and I think that we start to develop some of those ideas. But fundamentally I think that's an important issue for me, and that the show highlights. What are food and cultural boundaries? What does it mean to be Australian? It is imagined, but it's meaningful. It's meaningful. We want to make that imagining exciting and as meaningful as possible, and our food in turn as exciting, as tasty, as meaningful as possible. You know,
It's interesting because it seems like in other, you know, in a lot of other countries, and I guess this is just a factor of Australia being such a young country, but like if you look to Vietnam and you look at the French influence on Vietnamese cuisine, or, you know, all sorts of different cultural melting pots and the ways that cuisine has been influenced. There's what's the name of the, it's a Peruvian, the Peruvian Japanese fusion, because there's a huge Japanese culture in Peru. I can't remember what the name of it's called. And that's its own thing, like, and that's revered for this combination of cultures, and there's fine dining chefs over there that take it to the nth degree and things like that, and but it's never sort of defined in the ways that we're sort of talking about. It's like Australia is a young country and we're struggling for a food identity, and people sort of saying that fusion and Australia's like Australian food is multicultural food, and, you know, and now we have indigenous ingredients and indigenous food traditions to talk about and things like that. But it seems like other places in the world don't struggle as much as we do to try to set these boundaries and to try to, you know, give Australian food or give their food a label.
Historically, fusion food would have happened when different people from different countries were invaded or moved, and they had to use the ingredients were there. So they used their history, their techniques, their palate to interpret ingredients. Now we're in a world where you can get, you know, hold of everything. That kind of pressure to create that slightly more unified food face just isn't there. So now it's kind of, how do we interpret this? And I think it's a complicated issue.
Vietnam's just interesting here, because Vietnam's such a mix. There's no, especially Vietnam's such a, like, its geography is interesting because it's there with China, it's Southeast Asia influence on the south side, the French are in there, the Americans are in there, the Soviet influence too. So it's such a mix. And I think, and I lived in Vietnam for a while too, when I was a baby, but also later on. But it's hard to actually sort of dissect what Vietnamese think about certain foods like pho or things, particularly around pho or things that they say are distinctively Vietnamese, right? I think for Viets, they operate, and maybe all of us like this, we operate on different levels about their appreciation and claim to food as part of their identity. So pho, I think Vietnamese would think in their gut and in their heart, which is important, it's a Vietnamese food, it's true as true can be, there's no appropriation, you know, that's it. Even and sort of north and south differences too, but whatever, it's fully Viet, it's always been Viet, they feel it in their gut and heart. But they know in their mind that there's Chinese and there's French influences with pho too. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I think that awareness is good. Know that food operates and culture operates different parts of your sense of being, and one could celebrate that. I wonder if that's a model for Australia. Australia's, you know, maybe we'll have essential things, the lamington or whatever. I don't even know the I'm pretty sure pavlova we fight with.
I mean, that's kiwi.
Yeah, so there. So, but yeah, but I
to me, Australian food is more about like the ingredients, like macadamias, mango, avocado. I mean, I know avocado is like elsewhere too, but I guess these are the quintessential things that like I miss about Australia when I'm overseas, because you can't access those, you know, fresh, good quality ingredients.
Yeah, that's a great point. I never thought about that. What is Australian food?
What is
you guys
it?
Know, you tell
I've, us. I've been asking this question for 8 years since I moved here, which led me to using native ingredients in my restaurant so much. There's really, like, there's confectionery Australians seem to hang on to, and then there's European dishes, like, you know, meat pie, like, which has become quintessentially Australian, but it's not something that Australia invented, as it were. but it is kind of held up in that kind of cultural sense. So it's just very confusing that, that really, realistically, why Australia is not bringing anything to the food picture that they haven't kind of taken from somewhere else, which is why I think there's a bit of a fight here, is we should really just be embracing.
Avo on toast, mate. First time.
With some chili flakes and garlic.
No, do you know what? To be honest, like, and this is separate from what Australian food is, because we will talk about Indigenous ingredients in a sec, and obviously it's something that you're really passionate about, and I think that it is, and like you mentioned, macadamias, all those sorts of things. There's so many out there, and it is the future. But one thing that Australia has done is exported a cafe culture to the world didn't exist anywhere until it existed in Australia.
We made and Starbucks fail.
Go us.
That's exactly. We made Starbucks fail.
Proudest moment.
Yeah. So we have. There's people in Australia that led a coffee culture that respected international coffee producers in developing countries and ensured that they were paid enough and had a reverence for coffee that wasn't mirrored anywhere else in the world.
Didn't it come from Italian immigrants in Melbourne?
I mean, that's the funny thing is that, like, it was bought here, Australia made it its own thing, made it better, and then it kind of got exported back.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it will have, you know, that Italian background. I do know some people, you know, traditional Italian coffee roasters and things like that, and the approach is very, very different to the way that Australia has progressed in terms of coffee and the science and the artistry and how bloody seriously they take it.
Well, I think Australia should accept that like, we're not inventing particularly new things, but we might be making them better.
Yeah.
I love the fact that you got access to all these amazing ingredients and that, you know, avocado, not an Australian ingredient, has become a quintessentially Australian ingredient because people bloody love it so fucking much. That's what I love about here. And I think people worrying about, like, oh, what's Australian food? It's like, it's Indigenous food and that's it. Like, let's just move on from that argument.
Yeah.
What's Australian food versus, like, what do I miss about Australian, like, food in Australia when I'm overseas? And it's not necessarily Australian food, but it's just the way we engage in food culture and food, like, just cooking or restaurants. I miss so many good, like, Australian restaurants when I'm overseas. Mm. And a lot of the times they are multicultural restaurants. And I just think, I don't know, they're just really good here in comparison to elsewhere. I think, I don't know, we have a bit of respect for food here, particularly the ingredients and the quality of it. So my two cents on that.
Can I ask a question of you three? That it's, I think it touches upon a lot of the things we've been exploring today around issues of judgment and authenticity of food and of cultures. So I'd put it this way, like, when is it okay to, what judgment should we make? And when is it okay to eat buttered chicken and sell butter chicken, or you could replace it with Mongolian lamb, because as I understand it, they're dishes that come from, associated with huge civilizations and countries, but as I understand it, those people would have never eat those things. So there's other things like pad thai where they eat them on the street, right? But these are totally made for a Western palate, right?
I mean, like, curry's made in England for, like...
I don't think anywhere in India they'd sell butter chicken not for Western people.
Butter chicken is, I think, British chefs and British Indian restaurants kind of claim it. Mm. It's based on, like, chicken makhani, which I think is based on something else, which is traditional.
Oh, that's a good thing. I've had it with chips once in the
UK. Chips and curry sauce in the UK.
But it is okay sometimes.
But yeah.
It is okay sometimes. I've really got onto butter chicken after avoiding it.
I've actually never had it.
After avoiding it for ages because I thought it was inauthentic, right? Mm. It's tasty as for me.
Mm. It was tasty. So, who cares, man? Like, eat it.
Yeah.
But I think that, like, I mentioned earlier, there's a kind of badge of honor of not eating butter chicken, what's the chef's, like, you know, what's the chef special? Like, you know, what do the Indian people eat when they're here? There's this kind of thing of we want to get the real deal. We don't want to, I think it possibly comes from a place of wanting to embrace and not wanting just to eat the westernized version, to wanting to actually have the real experience. So that comes from a kind of a place of wanting to embrace this multiculturalism. But then also the backlash to snobby. Like, if you like butter chicken, eat the butter chicken. They're probably making better money off the butter chicken than the fancy dish.
Yeah, well, it comes down to... there's a multiple, food can play so many different roles, right? it's to nourish you. It's to bring you together with your friends and your family. It's to enjoy. So yeah, if you wanna, if you're hungover on a Sunday and you know you're thinking about what to eat for dinner and like butter chicken is gonna hit the spot, then of course it's delicious. Like butter chicken's great and stuff, but like. That's where it stops. You know what I mean? Like if you want to show an interest in, you know, regional Indian cuisine, then that's a different role you're looking for food to play. So it just sort of depends on where you are and stuff. And I guess it's things like the food media and a growing reverence and, you know, identification of the differences between regional cuisine in maybe Vietnam or in China or wherever it may be. And seeing these things creep into the mainstream and stories begin to be told where food plays that other role of being able to, you know, make people aware of culture, you know, international culture and telling these stories and things like that as well.
There's stories of Delia Smith, the thing in Australia.
Yeah. I know. I like it.
What's Delia Smith?
She's like the OG British food celebrity, like celebrity chef. Like she was on heaps of shows. But there was like the thing in, I mentioned it was the '90s, like the Delia effect. Like if she used, and you know, '80s, '90s, if she used ginger in one of the recipes on a show, suddenly all the supermarkets,
Waitrose,
like, well, I mean,
oh no God, more ginger.
It wasn't that long ago that like, you know, big supermarkets didn't stock these things. Like we're quite lucky in the last 10, 15, 20 years.
Mm.
Like, but yeah, like she would use a product on her show and it would either sell out in every supermarket or the supermarket would just have to stock it. And these things became staples. Like there is a massive effect that, you know, TV can have on people's habits. Things,
yeah, MasterChef very much had that effect. I know, I mean, I've been a vegan since I think MasterChef's been on air, or vegetarian at least. And I do know that, you know, a lot of people didn't know that you could overcook steak or you could, you had to rest steak, all these different things about meat cooking. And my family were like, whoa, we have to rest meat before we eat it? That explains things. Or me growing up thinking that, like, I don't know, chewing on some tough steak was fun. I was like, yeah, this is how meat is. And it's not, you know, and MasterChef brings these realizations of, you know, like different preparations of how to, you know, cook food, but also different ingredients and different ways to mix the ingredients. And it's exciting, I think. You know, whether it's fusion or whether it's, as you say, like supposed to be, what do you say, like true blue or, you know, food or whatever. I think it does enable us to explore these things, but I think we also still have to ensure, as you know, the article talked about that we wrote or as we're talking about today, that we appreciate these cultures rather than just kind of exotify them or see them as like unique or different or just treat them in a different way. You know, I think we should very much appreciate rather than, other them.
Mm. 100%. Kim?
Much to think about, really.
Yeah, I can see you deep in thought there.
I'll go back to my the 15 great years of my life that I've spent working for free in a bakery, you know, and now and then.
You can make some good bread.
No, well, this is the thing. I can't. This is the thing. So that's why I'm so interested in these ideas of authenticity that often people will see me now, but it's what Stefan was saying about, there's different mindsets you take to food, and so I suppose you take to people who are making food, and I suppose it's about self awareness and awareness of other people, rather than particularly what you're eating and what that's about. But I don't know much about food. Our family had bakery for like 20 years, worked our guts out, and dedicated to it, but it wasn't. It was just making money. It was just making money. I think I don't want to play to that stereotype too, because there are other beers who are well into food and things like that, well into their bread and things like that. But we were there was a hole in the market. We worked our guts out. You got to get up at 3. You do the books and it's done at 9, you know?
But like that's really interesting.
Like so many migrants, but we weren't really that particular. I'm dedicated to that lifestyle. I still get up early. I'm dedicated to that work ethic, although that's waning mercifully. But the actual food itself, when people come and say, oh, Kimbo, I remember you at the bakery, you know, all that French. And I can understand what they're doing. It doesn't bother me. Oh, I know, you're a culture, a literati sort of person. You must have bred so meaningful to the Viet, the French influence. I remember when Ho Chi Minh was at Dien Bien Phu, all that stuff.
Oh, my God.
No, we're just trying to make money. We're just trying to make money off you white people. You know, the caramel slice means as much to me as the Saigon roll.
I was just saying you can make good bread because bread is hard to make. Like, it took me 8 years to make a good dough. But I find it interesting you talk about that story, and I think it's in stark contrast to a lot of the stories told on shows like MasterChef, where it's like, so-called, I'm using quote marks here, the good ethnic of that story of like my family worked in a restaurant and we, you know, love food and blah, blah, blah. And it's very much kind of like that story that a lot of non-white contestants on MasterChef have to kind of, I guess, play to, if that makes sense, like the stereotypes that are there. You know, you don't have people going, oh, I just want, you know, did that in my family thing to make money. Like, you know,
the complexity is that there is sometimes food's not reflecting of culture.
Yeah.
It's an economic thing. It's
fascinating that you talk about that, Kim, because you see in food media as well that like the places that have a really, really genuine and heartfelt, you know, story to tell about how the chef got into food and the family history and how much the food means to them and all these sorts of things are the places that are, you know, revered and highlighted by food media a lot of the time, like these authentic Italians, the sons of the daughters of the Lygon Street, old school people in Melbourne now, rejuvenating Italian cuisine in Melbourne or whatever it might be. But a lot of the time, and especially in hospitality, number one, it's an economic decision. Mm-hmm. It should be anyway. I mean, it's not all the time, but like if you're not making money, then the story's not worth anything because you don't have a restaurant. Mm. And it's just fascinating because, you know, there are a lot of people out there. Like, I mean, we look at burger shops and, you know, pizza shops and things like that. Now, you don't have to be Italian to open a pizza shop. It's just a good financial decision if you want to open a restaurant because dough doesn't cost much. Like, so, yeah, it's an interesting one.
There's another question I'm dying to ask.
Go for it.
Food experts that I have thought there are probably a couple of dishes that I've seen Vietnamese make that are homely dishes, you know, homely food. That search for authenticity is often connected to homely food, stuff you don't have to think about. That my mum and I know other mums, mostly mums, don't have to think about. They whip up, but almost never see in restaurants. I wonder. I think there's an incredible desire for those sorts of food, the secret hipster thing. I bet you haven't heard about this sort of dish, right? Yes. But somehow speaks to authenticity. Have you come across, are there other cultures that have those sort of foods? And why aren't they? Like I once had a mate and said, who lived in China, he was a white bloke here, and he lived in Vietnam. He said, why don't restaurants make the food that you eat at home? So that's the question I have. Like, is that a fair question to ask of various ethnic groups? I don't care who they are. And of the restaurant industry, that he asked, why don't you make in the restaurant and sell in the restaurant what you eat at home?
Mm. I think they do and they don't. It depends on what the restaurant is. I think, and I mean, I'm just like trying to sell one of the books that I have for sale on my website at the moment. But a book that I did called Farm to Flame was about a guy called Nicola Cotchia and his restaurant in the Southern Highlands. And he's like his dishes are fine dining dishes. He won a chef's hat and they're quite delicate and he does use tweezers to put things on dishes every now and then. But like so many of them, a really large number of them are essentially the flavors of his childhood and what his nonna and those sorts of thing and the influential food people in his life cooked. And he's actually reproducing that, but just adding some polish and sophistication to put it on a nice handmade ceramic plate in a restaurant to, you know, give to the people that want to expect
it's
something.
It's hard to make something fine dining, like anything. You just fucking build it up a little bit, garnish it with some stuff. Like it's really like people say like, oh, it doesn't lend itself to fine dining. Fine dining is like it's down to plating and
literally
the setting. Like it's nothing weird. I mean the,
and smaller.
Yeah, exactly. yeah. I mean, the interesting thing might be is that something like French cuisine and traditional French cuisine is seen as this automatically seen as this fine dining cuisine. It's, you know, tornadoes, Rossini, and it's foie gras. But that's not how most of France eats and historically eaten.
Mm. It's bread.
But yeah, it's bread. It's, you know, it's lots of very like peasant homely dishes. So it's interesting that the, you know, media and people's opinions of that cuisine would go straight to restaurant cuisine rather than the home cuisine.
Mm.
Whereas when you talk about traditional with you know, Vietnamese cuisine, it's straight away. It's home cuisine and not what restaurant cuisine might be.
Mm.
So kind of, I think people have that sort of image in their head of what constitutes authenticity, whether that's true or not. I mean,
also the obsession of street food versus, you know, fine dining or restaurants or whatever. Particularly looking at Southeast Asian cultures that have been, you know, I mean, this has been on Play of Origin and MasterChef and, you know, narratives
in both those shows, and I think that contributes to the stereotype that Southeast Asian cultures don't have so-called fine dining because everyone just goes street food, like automatically goes to that thought. Which is, a ridiculous stereotype, as we just discussed.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. I mean, even like the Greek team in Plate of Origin, the first team was like, Greek food is about having big plates of food. And then that was what they were shown to be. Yeah. So, the thing we're going back to poo, Plate of Origin. The decisions the producers made of what teams to pick when they would have had heaps of applications and they've gone, oh, these French guys are going to be great. One's got a big old mustache and a top knot. The other one is like doing press-ups in the kitchen and they're both arrogant. They'll represent France for us. The Greek team, oh, it's two mums. They'll represent Greece. So the decisions they made of what teams to pick and to choose and then obviously how to edit it, that's telling as to what they think. I don't think they thought too much about it, but what they thought was authentic for each country.
Mm. Yeah, I think that there is a movement in food now of it is moving away from fine dining. Like restaurant culture has changed so much, and I think there's a show on Netflix called Ugly Delicious that is a reverence for the artistry behind food that would be considered, you know, basic, like fried chicken or pizza or noodles or, you know, dumpling. Yeah, like dumpling. You know what I mean, and it really goes into depth and sort of follows international chefs around the world. One's there's a Japanese pizza chef in Tokyo that, you know, they sort of display it in the it's just he's such an artist. And he only does margarita pizza or two types of pizza on the menu and things like that. So I think, I don't know, with the question about sort of where does home food fit into restaurant culture and stuff now, I think it's there. Maybe not exactly what we'd be cooking at home and stuff, but I think that there's this growing appreciation that what has been traditionally considered basic food, just your standard weeknight thing, there can be artistry and, you know, reverence and all the traits that chefs have and passionate chefs want to put into their food, put into anything, really.
Mm. What a valuable insight. I feel like that foods are a reflection of a global vibe, this search for authenticity. You can see it in fashion, in politics, whatever, you know what I mean? Mm. A distrust of stuff with sheen on it that's been highly marketized, that's been processed to the nth degree, you know, in food and in so many other things, and the whole hipster culture generally, I find, which is a search for authenticity.
I mean, like I was saying before, the fact that everyone eats, everyone's interested in food at some level, I guess what people's food choices are is a representation of kind of up to, you know, something like up to global politics and what is going on in the world and what people are searching for probably is a representation of what is happening on a kind of world scale.
Mm. Okay, guys, we do have to wrap up now, but do you guys want to quickly touch on anything else before we finish off?
Not sure. I don't know. I just love food.
Fantastic.
No, it's been a great honor. It's been a great honor to think through and talk through food and culture and politics and the media and how they all come together. It's been a great honor to listen to you two guys too.
Yeah, well, it's been wonderful for us as well.
We went around a bit, but I think the overall message is we need better representation in media, on shows, and people making the decisions for these shows.
Mm. True representation rather than just token.
And Plate of Origin very much highlighted that fact.
Okay, well, guys, if you come across anything in your studies, in your work, that's food for thought, as it were, before we're next in Canberra, let us know. And we'd love to sort of jump back in and touch on a different aspect of food and culture and politics and things like that, because, you know, the work we do that's very hospo-centric a lot of the time and sort of catered for people that are in the food industry like us, it's fantastic to sort of step outside that and talk about broader issues. So welcome back anytime.
Awesome. Thank you.
Glad we could feed each other.
Awesome. Thanks guys. So much, guys. Hello, dear listeners. Steph here. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of The Food Fight. If you want to get in touch with us, it's at The Food Fight Podcast on Instagram or thefoodfightpodcast@gmail.com. We want to hear from you and we want to talk to you. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. That really helps. If you want to hit me up, it's quicksandfood.com or at quicksandfood on Instagram. And if you want to get in touch with Simon, it's Simon_Evans_TBD on Instagram. Thanks so much for tuning in and we'll catch you again with another episode.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.